Blog Talk Radio.
This is from Kelly, Kelly, Kelly Manjaro, Tanzania. Come on, help us to help a lot of people here, man. It's gonna go everywhere in Africa. Prime speed, I'm gonna tell you about Homo.
You wanna hear about what I wanna tell about? Nataka kufikia, nachotaka kuongea. Homo Empathy, Homo, Homo Empathy. Homo Empathy, Homo, Homo Empathy.
Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. From time to time, we will have a special presentation on a variety of topics. Homeopathy is a show hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brooks. Please contact HWC if you would like to help support the show as a sustaining member or have suggestions for future shows. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your questions. Please share by tweeting on Twitter, posting on Facebook and MySpace, and all other social networks. You may select the widget and place the player on your blog or website. With gratitude to all our listeners, let's go!
Welcome, everyone. Today is July 17, 2013. Welcome to all of our guests and listeners. We're going to be talking about Herbert Roberts, Modern Medication, and the Homeopathic Principles. But first, I'm going to give you a inspirational quote, as I like to begin my day or programs. This is from a letter from Rav Schneerson that says, "Even if all your complaints about your spouse are well-founded and valid, show her your love nevertheless. Show her unconditional love. It is said that all our exile is due to the sin of unconditional hatred. When each one of us will start with unconditional love in our own domain, from there, it will spread to all else that we do, and from there to the entire world, speedily in our days. Amen." And I say this because very often I tell people that each person is a world unto themselves. And if we can improve ourselves individually and take note of our own thoughts, words, and actions, then that can spread to everything and everyone who we touch and come in contact with. And that means over social networks. I also want to talk a little bit about an article that I saw on the internet in the dailymail.co.uk. That says, "Winning sheep farmer finds success with homeopathy." And we must applaud all of those people who are out there using homeopathy for their garden, for their pets, for their animals and farms, and in the home, in their clinics. Wherever you are using homeopathy, the more success stories that get published out on major news media, the more people will be reading about it. And some people even say, even if it's negative information, just simply the fact that the word homeopathy and people need to go and investigate what that is means that more people will learn about it and have the opportunity to try it themselves. So this experienced farmer and owner of an award-winning pedigree sheep said that he found success with using homeopathic remedies on his stock. His name is Lester Peel, and he owns a farm at Over Silton near Osmothery with his wife Sue and son James. He was awarded just this year the J. Parler and Son Perpetual Challenge Trophy for the Champion Suffolk at Sunday's North Yorkshire County Show. Now, this man obviously knows his animals and is going to do the best he can for them to keep them healthy. and in tip-top condition in order to win such a prize. He's been sheep farming for 40 years. That's a lot of experience. And it's been particularly difficult for 12 months for sheep farmers. The last 12 months, he lost more than 20 lambs to a disease called Schmallenberg virus. And he struggled with worm infestations among the flock last year. And at the beginning of this year, he decided to try complementary therapy, homeopathy. And one day, we're going to say mainstream medicine, homeopathy. He has said that he's seen positive results with homeopathic remedies that he has fed his flock. He told the news reporters that the Schmallenberg has been a very bad round this year, and he was thinking about having it as bad as we did. He hopefully would, we've built up a resistance now. Quote, but I'm going more down the homeopathic route. Most of my sheep this year have had a proprietary wormer and a homeopathic wormer. Up till now, we've not been hit by anything, and if I stick with it, we should hopefully again build up resistance. I've recommended it to a lot of other people for various things as it appears to be working. I'm seeing results. I think a lot of people turn to methods such as this but tend to keep mum about it, meaning they hush-hush, they're quiet about it. But to me, if it works, then that's all that matters. And that's true. So it's our personal experience that matters. And it's what we do in our homes and in our yards and in our fields that matters. Not what other people tells us is possible. Because you know the greatest innovators, the greatest healers, the greatest people that we all admire and turn to are people who said, who defied the odds and who said, it doesn't matter if you tell me it's not going to be feasible, if it's not scientific, if it's not going to work based on your parameters. But if I think it's going to work, then I will defy the odds and I will try my hand at it and be persistent to see if it will. I'm trying to prove it to myself. If I can prove it to myself, then that's what counts. So, we, of course, know that other people will say negative things about this man, but if he's taking good care of his sheep, who are not going to be susceptible to placebo. And, of course, people will say they've been giving, he gave also the proprietary wormer. And how are you going to know that that is not what improved the animals? Obviously, if he's been using these wormers and using these conventional methods to build up the flock and prevent the disease, it wasn't working. That is the reason he had to turn to homeopathy. And then the other thing that I want to make note of here in this article is that he consistently says, build up resistance, which means that he's building up the immune system within the animal themselves. That he's not trying to be on the defensive of fighting a germ. Rather, he is being on the offensive, and he is improving the general health of the animals. And that's what we really need to do. So now I'm going to go ahead with our discussion for today. Dr. Herbert Roberts, Modern Medication and the Homeopathic Principles. If you have any comments or questions on the chat, you may post it there, or you can call in at 347-945-6956 in the United States, or using the little blue Skype button. And I thank everyone who's here today. If you want to send out an email to your friends, a tweet on Twitter, or a post update status that you're listening on Facebook. So here we go. Like all principles, those of homeopathy have been discovered and evolved through the crucibles of time, experimentation, and increasing enlightenment. Like all principles, too, they stand whether or not they have the ascription of those who profess to be their adherents. what does he say? It's kind of big words. He's saying whether or not anybody says anything about it, it's a principle. It's not going away and it's not changing. It's like one and one is two. That's it. He says they are principles that to those who understand and seek to apply them and to those who benefit from their application stand preeminent, unchangeable, in spite of all changes in therapeutic fashions. So styles and fads may go, come and go, but homeopathy is here to stay. To principles, there is no time element. Natural law knows no ancient, no modern. Time offers only the greater opportunity for examination of the results of applied principles, the action of the natural laws, and evolution knows not the meaning of fashion. Your skirt maybe goes up or down, your shoes may be rounded or pointed, but the laws will remain. The word modern must always be used in a comparative sense. This is never appreciated more keenly than when considered in the light of medical practice. And those elements of the practice of today that have survived the crucible of time have rightly become recognized as the principles of the art. Medicine, while always dealing with the ills of mankind, have passed through a continuous barrage of modern discoveries. Every day there's a new modern discovery. There's a new package. There's a new update. There's a new drug. And what is it and who are those who are manipulating all of those modern discoveries? Some of them are great and some of them are not so great. And that's my own commentary within the reading. Greater possibilities of investigation of the functions of the body have increased our knowledge of life processes and the circumstances of living, and this increase in knowledge has been of inestimable value in dealing with human suffering. But therapeutics, as demonstrated by modern medicine, is still in a state similar to that of the past, in that the discovery or development of the day is the seeming answer to almost all therapeutic problems. And I want to interject here. How many millions, billions, and trillions of dollars is thrown into research, into investigation? How many decades have we been trying to, quote-unquote, cure cancer? And how many fundraisers have there been? How many telethons have there been to raise money for these causes? And where has it gotten us? And think about that. Think about the amount of money that people have given from their heart because they believed that some of these modern methods or modern investigations into research will help find a cure for this or that disease. Dr. Herbert Roberts says, this is another way of saying that in spite of the increased knowledge of the mechanism of the body, no guiding principles have been discovered by the dominant school of medicine that are sure and certain indications in the field of therapeutics. This means there is no test but that of experience for any therapeutic agent. And modern medicine, despite the period of its discovery, still finds itself on a basis of empiricism rather than of true science. So we need to go back to experience. Just like the farmer, it's his experience that verifies, proves, and confirms for him whether something is working or not. We do not need to know that there is one molecule or no molecules in the ocean, or how many, whatever they tell you, one to so many percentage-wise, because that's not really what we need to focus on. That's not what we need to look at our attention on. We need to look at, does it work for you? Consider the discovery of the synthetic group of drugs. There has been a continuous procession of these substances over a period of years. Aspirin, luminol, which refers to phenobarbital, the phenols, the sulfanamides, sulfanilamides, the vitamins, and numerous others. Each discovery has been hailed as a modern development of science for the conquering or alleviation of the ills of mankind. And we know about antibiotics and antibiotic resistance. We know about all of these developments and what is the outcome with the overuse of them. Sober investigation of these of the claims of these therapeutic measures astounds us with the conviction that in almost every instance, the target at which these measures are aimed is a single symptom, or at most, a small group of symptoms, and not at the patient, him or herself. In most cases, the discovery of such a therapeutic agent has been met with loud acclaim and ardent advertising. Why advertising? Does it need advertising if it really works? Wouldn't the information spread like wildfire? Its use became widespread very shortly. Soon, the sincere students of science perceived, through their laboratory research and from clinical observations, that there was another face to the seeming curative action of the substance that was not without danger to the patient, and therefore warnings were sent out that there should not be too free use of the substances except under the most careful observation. In the meantime, the fashion of use had spread, especially among those who always seek the easy road in therapeutics, the uninstructed, and those who are addicted to self-dosing, with a corresponding amount of further damage to health. So he's probably referring here to all the over-the-counter, easily accessible and available drugs today that you go to the pharmacy, and you can get all of these antihistamines and anti-inflammatories and anti-this and anti-that that are targeting a specific symptom that you have without realizing that in a holistic way that you are more than simply that one inflammation, that one itch. You are much more than that. And that's why homeopathy, as he says, is a guiding principle. And that is what moves homeopathy forward, because it is a law of nature. And that's where we do our research, studies, and our actual clinical work, therapeutic work. So I have a little pullout here. The luminol is the phenobarbital. It's a barbiturate. Yes, it is habit-forming. That's why he says when people are given this as a prescription or they go to the pharmacy and they get it themselves, they are self-medicating and they are getting addictive to these different drugs. It's the barbiturate is the most widely used anticonvulsant worldwide and the oldest still commonly used. It has a sedative and hypnotic properties, but as with other barbiturates, it has been superseded by today the benzodiazepines for the same symptoms. The World Health Organization recommends its use as first line for partial and generalized tonic-clonic seizures, which are grand mal, in developing countries. It is the core medicine in the World Health Organization model list of essential medicines, which is a list of minimum medical needs for a basic healthcare system. And in more affluent countries, it is no longer recommended as first or second line choice anticonvulsants for most seizure types, though it is still commonly used to treat neonatal seizures. So here you have to question, do they have no other arsenal? Do they have no other means of helping these individuals who are having these problems than to give them these phenobarbitals, these luminols, these addictive types of drugs? So you have to question that. Why are they not investigating something that is more gentle acting and would not be addictive? Why are they not thinking of ways to build up the immune system and the resistance as the farmer has. What about phenols? The major use of phenol, consuming two-thirds of its production, involve its conversion to precursors to plastics. Okay, so we know plastics are not going to be the greatest thing in our environment. The condensation with acetone gives off bisphosphonal A, a key precursor to polycarbonates and epoxide resins. So we know that all of these things are plastics in the environment. These are the phenols. The phenols also are a versatile precursor to a large collection of drugs, most notably aspirin, but also many herbicides and pharmaceutical drugs. Phenol is also used as an oral anesthetic and analgesic in products such as chloraseptic, and other brand name and generic equivalents. They're commonly used as to temporarily treat pharyngitis. How many people have purchased a chloraseptic spray and had a sore throat sometime in their life and used it to spray the back of their throat? So now you know this is a phenol. And Dr. Herbert Roberts is saying that these are fads that come and go, but do not take care of the long-term illness for the patient. Thanks, all you listeners, for tuning in today. Sulfanilamide, also it's spelled with an F or with a PH, is a sulfonamide antibacterial. And again, how many people have had to get their kids sulfur drugs, all the different variety of sulfur drugs? And we know sulfur is a major polycrest in homeopathy. Well, it is a molecule containing a sulfonamide functional group attached to an aniline. That's the chemical analysis of it. It is used for antibiotics, and it functions by competitively inhibiting, by acting as a substrate analog, inhibiting enzymatic reactions involving the PABA, para-aminobenzoic acid. PABA is needed in enzymatic reactions that produce folic acid, which acts as a coenzyme in the synthesis of purine, pyrimidine, and other amino acids. And we all know that our DNA is composed of these amino acids, and it is very important that our balance of enzymes in the body are well-tuned. So does this mean every time you are inhibiting these enzymatic functions, you are stopping the body from working properly, but you are probably, as the antibacterial, you're killing the bacteria, but what are you doing to the rest of the body? That is the big question. And why do we need these drugs if there are other means? I mean, in an emergency, hey, I say use it. If it's emergency and there's nothing else working, you've got to fall back on the big guns. These, you know, like shoot everything in your path kind of thing. But now let's go back to, that was my little takeout quotes from defining these drugs that he's talking about. Now, Dr. Roberts says, such an agent was also aspirin. Such an agent, such a fad that came into being, and it's really become part of everyday medicament today. People take it because they want to keep their veins, arteries, blood pressure, heart under condition, and they're told to take a baby aspirin every day. Do you think that this is going to be a benefit in the long term? And there's some controversy about that, and you can read about it if you do a web search. So Dr. Herbert Roberts says, first advanced for its harmless sedative properties in the control of pain, it was widely used and in considerable amounts by physician and layman alike, until its depressant properties came to be respected by careful therapeutics. So I don't know whether he's talking about the fact that if you use an aspirin in terms when someone has a fever, you're not allowing the body to actually do its innate job that it knows how to take care of the acute situation and clear whatever needs to be taken care of, raising the body's temperature so the virus or the bacteria can no longer live there. But instead, we are afraid of these fevers and we take aspirin. Or if you have pain, will you continue to have to take aspirin every month, month after month, because the pains are not really being taken care of at the core, the reason why you've got the pain? So the American Medical Association, he says, found it advisable to publish warnings against the use of this substance, which was commonly sold under the trade name of aspirin. But the use of the substance was not curtailed to any marked degree, except by the most careful prescribers. So you know anybody can go to the drugstore today, the pharmacy, or even the grocery store, and pick up as many bottles of aspirin as they like. Nothing is stopping you. It has become a cure-all for domestic use, and all too often in hospitals and by physicians who sought first the suppression of the distressing symptoms rather than the cure of the patient. And so we know we have this drug and Tylenol as well. The homeopathic physicians have long known the dangers of suppressive measures and have always had due respect for the innate powers of any medicament. It was Hahnemann who observed that any drug was poisonous if dangerous dosage was given. Therefore, it is to be expected that homeopathic physicians early recognized the dangers of the synthetic drugs, among them the coal tar derivatives. The ability of the trained homeopath to observe and correlate symptoms made it a foregone conclusion that he would easily trace the depressed vitality, the heart attacks, and many collapsed conditions to the frequent use of aspirin and like painkillers. So we know aspirin is going to affect the heart. It's going to affect the totality and the vital force of the individual, not just the pain sensations, not just making the blood flow a little bit thinner. The homeopathic physician is likewise trained to realize the dangers of suppressed or masked symptoms. That pain has its... So what he's saying here is that by taking these drugs, we are masking the symptoms that we need to be able to elicit in order to find the proper simillimum. The pain has its beneficent aspect as a guidepost, and that the discomforts of any acute cold or gripe cannot be suppressed without grave danger to the ultimate health of the patient. The prevalence of the symptom, quote unquote, never been well since, is proof of this. The phenols, which I described, and especially phenobarbital, were hailed loudly as curative, and especially as palliative of many ills. It was not long before their deadly nature was discovered and the warnings were posted against their use. They are still used extensively, but much more conservatively than formerly. In many of these instances, it is the early dangerous action that is discovered, and later, more insidiously, and the long-lasting effects are undiscovered or ignored until too late. These become constitutional and therefore are unrecognized. So he is telling us that there are effects of these drugs that are listed on the literature, or they have not been listed because it takes long-term use of a drug to discover them and therefore to be labeled. And this was a recent court case. Something happened where a child was affected, but because the information was not listed in the literature, they were not able to get a remuneration initially. However, this is another part of the story talking about drug trials and the long-term understanding of what these drugs can do. So he says they do have dangerous action. that we understand over time. The other thing about these drugs is they are habit-forming, which I mentioned. Phenobarbital is habit-forming. The tolerance psychologically and physical dependence may occur with continued use, and therefore you will see these adverse reactions, these warning labels, drug abuse and dependence. And to minimize the possibility of overdose or the development of dependence, the prescribing and dispensing of sedative, hypnotic, barbiturates should be limited to the amount required for the interval until the next appointment. Abrupt cessation, this is a problem if you decide you want to go off of these drugs after prolonged use in the dependent person, will result in withdrawal symptoms. And they can include delirium, convulsions, and possibly even death from withdrawing from phenobarbital. So you can see why we have to have warning labels. The acute and chronic pain, caution should be exercised when using phenobarbital when it's administered to patients with acute or chronic pain, because paradoxical excitement could be induced or important symptoms could be masked. And that's also written on the literature. So they're confirming what Dr. Roberts says about masking important symptoms. However, the use of phenobarbital as a sedative in the postoperative surgical period and as an adjunct to cancer chemotherapy is well established. So these are areas where it is still in use. What about pregnancy? We always get a warning label on the bottle, a drug bottle, about pregnancy. It says that phenobarbital can cause fetal damage when administered to a pregnant woman. Retrospective case-control studies have suggested a connection between the maternal consumption of phenobarbital and higher-than-expected incidence of fetal abnormalities. Following oral administration, phenobarbital readily crosses the placental barrier and is distributed throughout fetal tissues, with highest concentrations found in the placenta, fetal liver, and brain. So can we extrapolate out of that? What is phenobarbital doing if it can cross this placental barrier? What is it doing when you take it for different situations? How will it affect your liver? How will it affect your brain? Withdrawal symptoms occur also not only in adults, but in infants that are born to mothers who receive this drug throughout the last trimester of pregnancy. And there's one other thing. The synergistic effects, the concomitant use of alcohol or other CNS depressants may produce addictive CNS depressant effects. And you can find that online at all of the medical websites. Of course, all of these effects from first to last are homeopathic proof of the potentialities of cure that lie in these synthetic drugs. To the homeopath, however, there should be but one criteria for their use: the similarity of symptoms produced in the healthy for application to like ills in the sick. The popular sulfanilamides are one of the best instances of the powers and dangers of synthetic drugs. They have been hailed for their powerful action in infections of many. One is tempted to say all kinds. It is true that in the laboratory and clinic they have proven this power, but along with the proven power of destroying invading organisms, they have a like danger to normal cell balance. This has been recognized by those who developed the drug to the point where careful therapeutics will not use these agents without keeping careful laboratory check on the bloodstream and other functions of the patients. So he's talking here about synthetic drugs, and they do have very powerful actions upon a person who has an infection. They have clinical trials. They have been proven in the lab. They have been proven on individuals. They definitely destroy the invading organisms, but they also have the like danger of destroying normal cell balance. Probably more variations of this group of the drugs have been developed than of any other that has become popular. When Sulfanilamide was first publicly recognized and marketed. It was permitted to fall into the hands of laymen who had read glowing accounts of its value and who decided that they could cure themselves of all their ailments with this wonderful panacea. Numbers of these hopeful sufferers purchased, and many deaths resulted. Manufacturers of the products were obliged to keep a closer watch on the production and distribution, and research chemists set about developing less dangerous combinations. So they knew and they understood, the manufacturers knew that they were dangerous to use, and they were constantly looking for ways to lessen the side effects. The fact remains that where medicinal agents are capable of eradicating organisms by any other method than by stimulation of the dynamic force to the point where nature itself balances the scale, there is danger to the patient sooner or later. So in a way, we could say that using energetic homeopathic remedies, it's not a matter of destruction and killing an organism, whether it be a virus, a fungus, or bacteria. Rather, it is making the environment in which it is inhabiting unworthy, uninhabitable for it to continue to be there, and it actually leaves on its own. That's basically what's happening. It's, you know, I'm doing an analogy. You think about a semipermeable membrane, how the salts naturally attempt to balance on the sides. So if you have a situation where the body is the soil and it is enables something to grow, live, and inhabit that space, if it can do that in a symbiotic, beneficial relationship to all parties, that is great. However, if it is only one-sided benefit, then it probably needs to be rebalanced in some way. So he says that it is no doubt that these sulfanilamides and its variations have a comparatively good record in such conditions as pneumonia and like infections. That is, a good record compared to that of the dominant school, where pneumonia is a dangerous and often fatal disease. And so he's making a comparison that typically whatever has been used during his time, the person did not come through it when they had pneumonia. They died with the kinds of drugs that they had at hand. But when the sulfur drugs came out, that actually was beneficial, despite the fact that they also had negative aspects to them. These sulfur drugs have so far given a more credible record than the serum treatments of pneumonia, which were so well sung only a few years ago. And in the use of these sulfonamides, only prompt use is necessary. One may omit the typing and thus save time. Oh, so he's telling us that if you have a named disease, you don't need to take the full and proper case, because you're just going to write out a prescription on that script pad. Here, take this sulfur drug and you should be better, without actually going in depth as to what is the core issue to rebalance that vital force in the individual. In fact, he says, it has been said by eminent authorities on the use of the sulfonamides that in infections, they must be used promptly at the onset of the infection of whatever kind, or they are useless. That's very interesting. I haven't heard that before, but he's saying that you need to take these drugs at the beginning of the infection. And I suppose today, if you were to go into the physician's office, which I had to do just a number of months back with an ear infection, the doctor immediately said, let's put you on steroids, which means that the infection she felt had gone too far gone. And this is the course of action today, to do cortisones, to do steroids, to do prednisones. and then follow up with the sulfur drugs or the other kinds of antibiotics that are being used today. So he says, let us analyze the situation. And by the way, I never did take those steroids, and I did get better. And homeopathy helped me. And, you know, to tell you the honest truth, I was in such great pain. I did end up taking the antibiotic, although I don't know that was the answer, because I was still sick after it. Anyway, thank God I'm well. Let us analyze this situation. Here we are given a therapeutic agent that will kill the invading organism with a corresponding dangerous action against normal functions of the body. Yet potent as this is, it is of no value against the invading organism after that has been established. Are we to believe that it's dangerous to the normal cells of the patient has diminished in proportion to its possibilities of help against the invader? So he's asking, do you think that it's different, the use of these drugs, the amount of powerful action that they have to kill the invading organisms? You think it is any different, the amount of destructive power that they have in the normal cells? That is his question. It has been many years, he says, since the possibility of sterile death has been acknowledged, the bloodstream being sterilized of invading organisms, yet death results. So how many times have you heard, well, we gave this drug and we eliminated, we see nothing in the test results, in the blood results, in the lab results, we don't see any more of this organism, and yet the person succumbs to death. What has happened in that situation? What has the drug actually done? He says, this is as true now as then, and the danger, well, I guess he's giving us a reminiscence of the use of mercury, which was, mercury killed the virus or the bacteria of the deadly disease, yet it also killed the patient. And we have reduced in medicine today, we have reduced the quantities and the dose, but still, we're still looking at a dose that can be change the body, that can change and not get the body back into balance. So he says it's true now as then, and the danger may be imminent or retarded in relation to the amount of the crude dosage or the frequency of its administration. Careful observers in both schools of medicine have noted the slow return to normal health of patients, quote-unquote, cured, i.e. the acute infection having been overcome by heroic methods, or as we may better say, by the application of forces outside of the normal functions of the body. So definitely, there are situations we need to take heroic action to save the life. But then over time, it takes a long time to rebuild that person, to rebuild that patient back into a normal state. He says, therefore, although the invading organisms have been limited in action, the system has to overcome the effects of the infection plus the toxic effects of the treatment. So here we're saying that the body is a system. It is a complete and whole system. It is a delicately complicated, well-tuned organism that we do not have all the information and all the facts on how it works. Yet, we use force, the outside force of these drugs and other applications to, you know, crudely, because we are not able to do what God does, unless we perhaps, I mean, energetically, we get a little bit closer to enabling the body to take on the healing action itself without force. So he says, now let us consider the sulfonamides in relation to the homeopathic principles. We might consider, in the light of our thesis, any or all of the synthetic drugs. But so far as we know, there has been no effect to exhibit the potential powers of the substances through the well-known and thoroughly tried method of Hahnemann, that of proving the remedy on the healthy human being. So we do know that clinical trials are using these drugs on select numbers of ill patients to see their effects. Do clinical trials use these drugs on healthy human specimens? I'm not sure that they do, but that is the method that Hahnemann used, and the disciples and followers of homeopathy, that is the method that they use to test the medicinal properties of plants, minerals, animals, and all other things. Such an attempt has been made in the case of sulfanilamide, notably by Dr. Alan D. Sutherland. The results of this fragmentary proving, so he took a synthetic drug, this sulfur drug, Dr. Alan Sutherland, and he proved it homeopathically, and this information was published in the Homeopathic Record for September 1940, which is many, many years ago, over 70 years ago. Dr. Sutherland's conclusions were that this substance, potentized, has great possibilities as a homeopathic remedy when we have more clearly demonstrated its field of usefulness by the sure guide of the symptomatic outlines that our principles demand. These are the only guides which provide safety and cure rather than uncertain palliation as opposed to suppression, making the person feel comfortable when we know that we cannot cure the person, of a condition that the patient later has to overcome through his natural vitality or else succumb to in some other and more deeply constitutional form at a later date. So he's telling us that these synthetic drugs are having an impact on our vital force, and the individual, the organism, holistically, will need to find a way to remove these impressions on the system. And he says either the patient is going to have a strong enough vital force to do this, or it's going to be a layer, something, a deeply constitutional form at a later date. It might change the individual. The homeopathic adage that we try to cure the patient rather than the disease might well be supplemented by this statement that we do not presume to snatch the patient from an acute illness from which, by the grace of his dynamic energies, he might be self-limiting. To force upon him a constitutional condition plus the imposed drug illness from which he may never recover. So here again, he's telling us that the body can naturally heal itself. We are a healing system. The body can naturally heal itself in situations of acute disease. However, when we go in and preclude the innate mechanisms of the body and we start tampering with them, such as the use of aspirin for fever, then we suppress the disease and we don't allow the body to have that discharge, to have that function. And the body is looking for a way to deal with the condition. He's saying that we might be creating a constitutional condition, something that weakens our organs, our vital organs. And he also says something which he may never recover from. So we might be looking at autoimmune diseases. We might be looking at arthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, or asthma, or something else. So what else does he tell us? The results of the homeopathic remedies in such infections as pneumonia, gripe, streptococcus, staphylococcus, and other generalized or local infections have been more remarkable than in any other system of medication. Therefore, way back in 1940, he knew, and he lived earlier than that, he was using homeopathy for all of those major illnesses that dealt with viruses and bacteria, and he was not living in today when we have antibiotic resistance to all of these diseases. This is a problem. So he says this is a simple way of saying that the natural laws upon which homeopathy is founded and upon which our principles are based work just as surely in serious, swift-paced onslaughts of disease as in any other condition. And one thing that we must realize is our homeopathic remedies are going to work. They're not going to become resistant this in the same way that antibiotics are going to do. It is true that in some of these conditions, the system is more deeply involved and death more imminent than in many conditions we are called upon to treat. So he understands the seriousness of these diseases. It is also true that many of these serious infections were cured before the laboratories were at hand to furnish accurate diagnosis, and that very often the most prominent result of the laboratory diagnosis is to weaken the courage of the physician, the patient, and the patient's family. What do you think he's talking about there? That when you get a diagnosis and you're told, when somebody is said, goes to the office or gets a phone call or gets the lab report after an x-ray or an exam or a blood test, and then they're told you have such and such a disease, you have cancer, you have lupus, you have arthritis. What is going through the totality, the mind, body, and spirit of that individual? Number one, it is a shock. And based upon experience and statistics, a person might put themselves into that, a particular category of whether or not they feel that they can get well. So he is telling us not only does it affect the patient, but that this news affects the courage of the physician, the patient, and the patient's family. And I might extend that to friends as well and community as well. He says, the homeopathic physician recognizes another important principle in these serious states. The more acute the case, the more the infection strikes at the life of the patient, the more clearly indicative are the symptoms. So for a homeopath, when you have an acute situation, when you have an acute set of symptoms, the homeopath should be able to recognize that much more clearly than in a muddled case, one that is not so acute. Obscuration of symptoms, he says, unless produced by crude drugging, is very rare in a case of acute infection. So if you've gone in and started to take some drugs, you're going to have a muddled case. You won't have the striking symptoms to look at unless you go back and inquire historically in that person. Although you may not be able to observe maybe the odor, maybe the redness, maybe the inflammation, maybe whatever it is has gone down, has gone away, so you cannot tell what is going on to get to that all-important homeopathic remedy. He says, however, the homeopathic remedy works regardless of the name of the disease and works, moreover, toward a true and complete cure. Without sequelae, any abnormal bodily condition or disease related to or arising from a pre-existing disease or constitutional involvement. So he's saying that the label of the disease that you get is not going to be of much regard. It will help in some instances to understand the common symptoms, to be able to use differentiation, to know what kind of exams will be helpful to see in the material world, so you can take a before and after picture and see some of these things for the scientific community. But all in all, homeopaths are looking at the symptoms and the individualized symptom picture, and the name of the disease may not be that important. He says the value of vitamins in the diet has been a burning subject among research chemists and therapeutists alike. And you know, vitamins are a big market today. The source of vitamins in natural foods, especially raw fruits, has been recognized for some time. And of course, sources of synthetic vitamins have been discovered and their use urged through the drug houses. So he is with us on that. The folks who are out there, those raw foodies, he would probably love you. And taking your greens, taking your multicolored fruits and your deep colored berries, these are the things, the sources of your vitamins that are natural in nature that we have evolved millions of years to take into our body and assimilate. The synthetic vitamins are something other. They are not natural forms. They are probably deemed, when you eat them, foreign to the body. And what does the body want to do with these foreign substances? They don't want to have them. They want to eliminate them, do they not? And it'll be more difficult to assimilate them into the fine network of the functioning of the body. But he also tells us that these kinds of synthetics, because they can be patented, are marketed and urged through the drug houses. One simple but obvious fact seems always to be overlooked by the manufacturing chemists, that while chemically the synthetic product may vary little from the natural, there is a difference which is recognizable in results, sometimes far removed in time from the experimental stage. It is hardly likely that a patient would suffer from too many vitamins through a normal diet. How many people can overdose of their vitamins through a normal diet? The vitamin is normally balanced with the other food values. So, in other words, if you pull out an active ingredient in, let's say, an apple, maybe you pick out the pectin, or you take out a vitamin particle, you're not getting the whole fruit. You're not getting the way nature made it, with the fiber and all the other things that we really don't even know how it works. We don't know everything. So now we've been reduced to our chemical composition, basically. Dr. Roberts tells us, with the increased regard for vitamins as necessity of life, we are now under a barrage of foodstuffs where added synthetic vitamins are an ineradicable part of the diet. So even decades and decades ago in the 1940s and 50s, and I remember when I was a young kid in like middle school or junior high, and I was looking at these packages of cereals and Frosted Flakes and Cheerios and Sugar Puffs and all of these sugary foods, I would read the ingredients and I would wonder, why are these preservative chemicals in there? What are they doing? And how can it possibly be good for me to take these chemicals? Then again, you try and read all of these vitamins under these different names and say, why are they in there? Okay, the government tells us this is good for us if we don't have folic acid, if we don't have vitamin C, if we don't have vitamin E and vitamin D and vitamin K, we're not going to be completely healthy. And everybody's taking a one-a-day vitamin. So what's going on? He says, since it has been found that these substances are necessary to life and development, argue the laboratory chemists, therefore, as a nation, we must take advantage of this source of increased energy and vigor. And since the synthetic vitamins have the same chemical construction and are easily available at a comparatively low cost, we must use these vitamins to the fullest extent. Therefore, they are introduced into many basic foods, such as flour, cereals, and everything else if you just go to the shelf and purchase a processed product. Thus, we have a business venture which is very profitable to the producers of the vitamins, and it becomes almost impossible for an individual to escape a diet heavily laden with synthetic vitamins. And here's a question. How much of these products are you eating? How much are you feeding to your kids? How do you know what is the correct amount for them to have? Whether your selection of foods are different from your neighbors, and you give all of one kind of spaghetti and cereal and different things that are processed in canned goods that have all of these additives to them, how do you know how they will respond in your child's body? How do you know whether it's too much or too little? How do you know that the synthetic product is not going to be welcomed by the body? So let's get back to nature, folks. Now he says, however, the careful research men who investigate carefully all sides of the question and take time to correlate facts are beginning to voice the conclusion that after long and critical study, they find there is a great danger from too many vitamins, as from too few and perhaps more. As a matter of fact, if he were living today, I wonder what he would say about all these petitions going around where we are getting less access to vitamins. That has supposedly been proven helpful. And I'm going to talk about orthomolecular medicine at some point, where vitamin C, Linus Pauling, has done so much research to show that it is very helpful to the body. And, you know, if you're purchasing a vitamin E, search out something that is completely natural. The origin is natural and not a synthetic, because it's not going to work. And the same vitamin D, they're breaking it down, vitamin D3. So you need to investigate for yourself what's going to be helpful to your body. So he says, at his time, they learned that there was a great danger from too many vitamins. And maybe he was living during a time where they were doing the mega vitamin intake. I know a lot of people were doing that a number of years back. This is a statement in accord with homeopathic principles and with the laws of nature governing balance in all things. Quote, the amount necessary to affect any change in nature is the least possible. Action and reaction are equal and opposite, unquote. And I want to make a little commentary here that when do we have the greatest success, the greatest accomplishment in our lives? When we are given something on a silver platter, or when we have to work for it and we can appreciate our accomplishments? That is a question that you can answer for yourself. And I'm wondering if that is also a universal law for everything in the world, that a person, an organism, whatever it is, a cell, when they're functioning properly, when they're working properly, when they're doing what they need to, instead of being carried along, told, had an assistant to do it, is that going to be the best production? Is that going to make that the happiest cell, the happiest person alive? So I want you to kind of think about that philosophically. Dr. Robert says, the manufacturing chemist states in his literature that it has been determined that the normal vitamin requirement is from 3 to 25 milligrams a day. We may expect that overdosing with vitamins, which have a constructive and maintenance value, would have two definite reactions. Okay, what are the reactions from taking the vitamins? First, a destructive action proportionate to its normal constructive action. And second, the permanent disability of the system to react to normal vitamin intake. You know, he's getting pretty down deep and heavy here. He's saying if you're taking vitamins, it means that you're getting that assist from an outside source, not your natural, your balanced food intake from natural food, but you're taking something, a supplement. He's saying that you're going to create possibly a destructive action proportionate to its normal constructive action, or secondly, the permanent disability of the system to react to normal vitamin intake. And you can picture in your mind a person who has to take insulin, and because their body isn't functioning, but you're not finding a way to help the body utilize insulin. Instead, you're giving them additional insulin, and that means the body doesn't have to function properly on its own, that is. So he says this latter is comparable to the effect of insulin administration in the diabetic patient. He soon loses his ability to produce the necessary secretion in his own economy. This is another illustration of the loss of function by the need being supplied through no effort, and there you have the word effort, of the patient. That's your work ethic, your work effort. That is the work that you have to do on your own to accomplish the task. If you give it to somebody without the work effort, the outcome is not going to be the same as if you have to work for it. He says the evolution bears witness to the fact that what a creature does not use, he must lose. That's something that everybody has heard, use it or lose it. And if you think about it, if you bring up a child and give that child literally everything on a golden spoon, that child is not going to know how to take care of that himself, him or herself. And is this a universal principle? I want you to ask yourself that. Think about it. Thus, the excess supply of vitamins robs the body of its normal reception of the natural vitamins. And I want to put a caveat in here that if you're really, really sick and you have scurvy, you're going to have to get a dose of vitamin C from the external source. Or maybe he would say, why don't we just give this person some citrus? Would that be sufficient? Depending upon the state of their pathology, I would imagine. Dr. Roberts says, one can hardly conceive of the effect of a high vitamin intake on a younger generation in the light of this conclusion, and we can hardly fail to consider the results of the unrestricted administration of these elements in future generations. Will they be able to assimilate them from natural sources? It's a good question. Or will there be, after a time, some radical change in the human economy to compensate? And that is really amazing statement that he's giving us. I'm thinking, you know, I'm alive 60 plus years and I've been fed all of these processed foods for how many decades? What has it done to my economy? What has it done to the way that my body would naturally and normally function? What are we doing when people are eating these power bars constantly, all day long? They're using these power bars that are filled with all kinds of vitamins and supplements. Does it tell the body, this is an unnatural form, does it tell the body, give it a message that, okay, you don't know how to take care of yourself, you don't know how to utilize natural foods, you just got to have this concentrate? So what is it going to do? Is it actually changing future generations? In particular, he says, we may inquire regarding the reactions and the special functions. Will these functions be permanently affected? For instance, it has been demonstrated that vitamins C and D help to overcome rickets, and that a certain amount of these are necessary for the proper growth and development of the body structure. It has also been demonstrated that excessive doses will cause rickets. So here we have the equal and opposite reaction, do we not? We, this is amazing. Where is this published? We're going to have to investigate that excessive doses of these vitamins will cause rickets. Since vitamin E is supposed to stimulate the generative function, will massive dosing destroy or impair this function? We might continue this analogy through the list of vitamins so far isolated and studied, and we know we have quite a few vitamins to roll through. It is well for us as homeopathic physicians not to overlook the potentialities of the synthetics in the field of therapeutics, but we must examine them carefully in the light of our well-proven homeopathic principles, remembering also that the findings of the clinic do not necessarily bear the same relationship to the human patient as to the laboratory animal, and that the secondary results may vary widely from, may be directly opposite to the primary results, which appear to be so brilliant and satisfactory. So here he is alluding to and referring to the primary and secondary action of homeopathic remedies, that the primary result is that initial aggravation. The secondary result is going to be the healing reaction and response of a good, solid, vital immune system, the vital force. And he is also indicating here that what goes on in the lab under the microscope or in the lab with a mouse or a rabbit or some other animal is not going to be the same thing as what we will see to bear in the relationship of the human patient. And that's why homeopathy, we do provings on people, healthy people, healthy specimens, as healthy as we can be, because we know everyone has something going on with them. We must remember, he says, that our homeopathic laws, if they are natural laws, as we have every reason to believe, are still worthy of our consideration, and that no sure guidance has yet been found that is not in accordance with those laws. So these laws are not unproven. These are fact. And that the test of time must be applied in every instance of a new discovery that has not been tried according to known law. It is foolish to reject the new just because it is new, but it is even more foolish to accept every new finding blindly without fully testing its validity when we have at hand all the means for sound procedure, means which the dominant school so far has failed to accept. And that is chapter 35 of The Principles and Art of Cure by Homeopathy, written by Dr. Herbert Roberts, M.D., an amazing human being on this planet who has given us such a wealth of knowledge and wisdom that has provided us a means of learning from the beginning. I would like to let you know that we have gone through each and every chapter on Blog Talk Radio over the course of many, many months, maybe even a year. You'd have to go back and look at the archives from chapter one. He tells us what was homeopathy, what does homeopathy have to offer to a young man, to a student, to a professional, to an allopathic physician, to anyone in the healthcare profession. What does homeopathy have to offer? He gives us a beautiful introduction on how to study homeopathy, and he teaches us about the vital force and what that is, because it is what enlivens us. He talks about the vital force as expressed in its functions in health, in disease, in recovery, and in cure. He tells us about the universal application of this vital energy of which we just spoke, a law, a truth, a principle that is never changing and is eternal beyond time. And he talks about the fundamental laws of homeopathy. He explains to us why our remedies act. And then he teaches us how he takes the case and analyzes the case and all about the law of cure. He also explains and goes into depth about the chief complaint and all the auxiliary symptoms in their relationship to the case the dynamic actions of the drugs, and then the question that everybody has on their mind, posology, the drug dose. Then he talks about remedy reaction and drug provings. So drug provings are important because people today are still carrying them on. Finally, he talks about homeopathic managing of the case because he talks about the second prescription. Finally, we get to susceptibility. This is each and every individual has different susceptibilities toward disease. Where are their weak organs? What is their hereditary line that provides our miasms? And he talks about suppression. Suppression of symptoms can happen, I imagine, with homeopathic remedies as well as with using, and he goes into depth in each and every chapter about the law of palliation, temperaments, local applications, which he, in most cases, is not going to be something that you want to do, because when you have symptoms on the outside that are observable, you want to keep those highest in your mind that the body is giving you information. It's telling you on the outside, or if you're a physician, you know how to do a complete physical. You can hear the heartbeat. You can check the tongue. You can see the eyes. You can see the facial countenance. You can check whether the body is perspiring, whether it's on the palms of the hands, the back, what time of day or night. He talks about all of these things, and he tells us local applications. If you stop the sweat, if you put antiperspirants on, you are causing most likely damage. And in relation to that, I would like to direct your attention to Gaia Health, the website Gaia Health, written by Heidi Stevenson, who has written two phenomenal posts in the past 2 weeks, all about the element aluminum, which is a polycrest for homeopaths, aluminum, this metal, and how it is pervasive, ubiquitous in our environment, in our medications, in our vaccinations, in our production of materials, and how this affects the body. And I got off on that tangent simply because aluminum is used in underarm deodorant, and if people put that on, they may be causing more harm than good. Perhaps they are suppressing their sweat, but what is the body going to do as an outlet? These are expressions of the body that must be looked at homeopathically. He also talks about temperaments in his own inimitable way. And of course, I just mentioned local applications. He talks then about disease classifications, which are our different groupings of classifications of remedies, and the miasms. He talks in depth about sora, about deficiency, about latent sora, syphilitic stigma, and that took two whole chapters, plus syphilis and psychosis, which also took another two chapters. Finally, he gives us a disease classification summary, the homeopathic therapeutics in the field of endocrinology, which is really top priority in most people's minds today, because we are messing up our endocrine system with all of the drugs out there, with all of the hormone replacements, with bisphosphonol A, which are hormone disruptors, and the glyphosates, which are causing sterility in male sperm and who knows what else. And we also have the endocrinology, that fine, fine tune balance of the human body. We're messing it up by introducing all of these plastics into our society and many other things that affect our endocrine system, including drugs. And the last three chapters in this book, I hope you'll go back and listen to, is the phenomenological viewpoint, the deflective current, and then today was modern medication and the homeopathic principle. He begins this work with saying, quote, "This work is dedicated to all seekers after truth in healing of every age and race. Thus, this is Dr. Herbert Roberts' legacy amongst many other books and publications that he has created, that those who want the truth, who seek the truth in every age, whatever race you are, whatever culture, homeopathy is the place you're going to end up. I believe that in the future it will be the number one method of introduction to healing, and that everyone will know about it, whether you are an elementary school child when you fall and you know that you have a different specific type of bruise, whether you have a specific type of insect bite or a rash or a tummy ache or fears or delusions, whatever it may be. I believe little children will know the basics of the homeopathic remedy kit. The middle school children, the junior high, the high school children will even start perhaps their practice helping each other through difficult times when the hormones are raging, when they have so many social and relationship problems. At a time that we are dealing with today with bullying in the workplace, at home, in school, in the social networks, bullying is so pervasive. And it's part of our violent society today, our violent society, which may be an outcome of the crude drugs that change the neurology of our brains and our nervous system and induce fear and break the harmonious functioning of our bodies. And there are many people who are whistleblowers, who are truth seekers, who are investigating their observations. There's a doctor, I think his name is Maldo, who will show you photographs of children before and after vaccinations and show you the changes in their facial structures, their physiology, whether the eye is turning in, whether there's a droop in the lip, whether there's a droop somewhere in the face, whether there's a wrinkle here or there, whether the head is turned a certain way. All different actual structural physiological changes can be seen in children who have been vaccinated, the before and after photographs. How can we dismiss this? How can truth seekers dismiss this? So it's up to us as the public. We're in the public domain. We are the people who are affected. We are the ones who must cry out and make a difference in the world. So I want to thank Dr. Herbert Roberts for his incredible work that has taken us all through this learning process. And I want to let you folks know that coming up on Thursday, tomorrow, we're going to have Alan Phillips talking with me about vaccines and your rights. Always great to talk with him and learn about current events. There's a lot of stuff happening. I might be able to give you even a little bit of heads up on some of that information. And if you're still listening to me, we have about 30, 35 minutes left to the show. I hope more people, I didn't send out a broadcast message to Facebook or Twitter, but if you're there, there's still time to let them know. There are things happening in our court system. There are drug companies that are being exempt from lawsuits, and this is a problem. This is going to take an incredible amount of effort, energy, and a lot of people fighting for their rights to get them back about this issue. We have many people who are creating videos that I have published and put up on Homeopathy World Community. I want to let you know that you can use some of the natural vegetables, root vegetables for healing. One of those is curcumin, found to outperform pneumococcal vaccine in protecting infants. So what do we have here? That vaccines are not protecting against pneumonia as well as feeding the body right. And you can read this up on preventdisease.com, that despite no evidence of its effectiveness to prevent disease, public health agencies and the medical community insist that infants and children between the ages of 2 and 12 months require up to 4 shots of pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, PCV. Now new research finds a substance in turmeric, that substance is curcumin, and hello folks, you don't need to take out the active ingredient. Put turmeric into your food. Put it in your sautés, in your spaghetti, or whatever it is that you're eating. This may outperform the vaccine in providing long-lasting protection against potentially deadly lung damage in infants. And the reason that we have concern is because the pneumococcal bacteria are the most commonly cause of bacterial infection in children and a frequent cause of infections in adults. Infection starts in the nose or the throat, where it may persist for weeks or months. And the pneumococcal infections are also the most common complication in seasonal influenza. So do not forget about our marvelous homeopathic bowel nosodes that also help to eliminate or deal with pneumonia, as some of our wonderful researchers, homeopathic doctors, have been using and talking about. So that's something that we need to look at. One other great thing about curcumin and turmeric is that it also can be helpful for a number of other labeled diseases, Alzheimer's, arthritis, cancer, even for weight loss and for Parkinson's. So it does have a lot of beneficial effects. One other very interesting news, and it's a little bit controversial, is that Jenny McCarthy, who she is a vaccine rights advocate, she is going to be the new host on The View. And I know lots of people around the world might not know The View. It is a very, very popular television show. And USA Today reports that Barbara Walters, everybody knows who she is, she was on The View and producer of The View. Barbara Walters confirmed on Monday's The View that comedic actress Jenny McCarthy will join the Chat Fest when its 17th season begins in September. McCarthy has appeared on the show already 17 times, including 8 times as a co-host, so she has plenty of experience. Quote from Jenny, "I will be doing everything I can to provoke conversation, make you think, make you laugh, and maybe even spill the beans on what goes on backstage," which means we might be hearing her personal opinions about the vaccine issue and the medical community today. And go, Jenny, we want to hear it. The people need to have mainstream information about taking care of yourself naturally and vaccines. What else can you find out on Homeopathy World Community? Well, we do have some marvelous, marvelous authors who are writing wonderful articles. One of those is Allopathy Facts, Homeopathy Facts and Real Facts. That is by Dr. M.A. Usmani, and I'll tell you what, he has provided us up to 70 articles, fantastic philosophical and practical articles about homeopathy. Very opinionated gentleman, but I'll tell you what, he's got some really thought-provoking words to read. And then we also have many others on here. A Case of Malnutrition has had a lot of views. This is by Dr. Saeed Tahir Hassan, about a boy who has had malnutrition and how he had a little conversation with the mom. I might as well read it to you if I have a little bit of time. This is a case of a boy who was 7 years old. He weighed 10 kilograms, thin, undernourished, and was brought for gaining both height and weight. The pediatrician had tested him and found no disease, and he prescribed tonics. But still the child remained the same. The kid is active and at times even hyperactive. His skin looks dehydrated and wrinkled, especially at the back of the hands, the face, the arms, and the feet. Dr. Saeed asks, did your kids suffer from any disease? Mother, the kid's doctor said he doesn't have tuberculosis or pneumonia. He's usually a healthy child. But the problem is he doesn't eat much, but keeps on playing the whole day. I have to force him to eat. Dr. Saeed, you mean your kid never ever had a fever or a loose stool or vomiting? The mother says he has been usually healthy over the past 4 to 5 years. He might have gotten an occasional cold, but was never given any treatment, while the younger kid is always on treatment for fever or coughs. At 3 years of age, he had herpes on his lips, and later it was on his chest. Dr. Saeed asks, how was he born? Any problems immediately after the child's birth? Mom says, he was born normally at the Pemna Hospital. He cried immediately, and on the 7th day he had circumcision. No problems at all. Dr. Saeed says, that's nice. Between 3 to 6 months, or between 6 to 12 months. Anything? The mother says, the kid's father spoke, quote, when he was about 11 months, he used to cry a lot before and while passing urine. It remained for 2 weeks. One day, we noticed sand in his diapers, but thought that that diaper got polluted. But after a few days, my mother pointed out that the urine passed by the kid used to crystallize into powder. We confirmed it when the kid passed urine in the diaper again. The local doctor gave some syrup, and it reduced it. So wouldn't you think that was the father who spoke up, and wouldn't you think that might have been suppressive, based on what we learned today? Dr. Saeed said, looking toward the kid's mother, don't you recall it? The mom says, I remember, but it wasn't such a huge problem. Dr. Saeed inquires again, was he able to pass urine while in sitting or sleeping position during those times? The mother laughs, oh, that's something unusual. I had to hold him up as if he was standing to pass out the urine. He used to pass freely while in the standing position. Isn't that odd for a child of 11 months? So Dr. Saeed came to a conclusion based on that particular rubric, that particular unusual and defining peculiar symptom, and he gave him a dose of sarsaparilla. And after 2 weeks, the child's weight had increased 2 kilograms, and after another month up to 14, he didn't gain 14, he went up from 10 to 14 kilograms. So everyone really approved of this, and David Kempson, who has also provided, using the sensation method, some incredible, wonderful articles on homeopathy world community, he says those peculiar symptoms are so valuable when you see them. He says, I have seen one urinary case with the same peculiar modality of needing to stand up to pass urine freely, although it was in an adult, not an infant. Nicely spotted. I have seen such good overall sarsaparilla cases, though. When everything fits, it's quite fascinating. And we do thank all of our physicians who provide their cured cases into our website. We also have one of thumb sucking that has been posted, a case of extreme isolation, which was by David Kempson. And I think he is in something like Australia or New Zealand, someplace where he can't get up and do a show with us, which I would have loved. And talking about shows, we're going to have on Monday, Phyllis Georgic will be back with us again, and we're going to go into 1 whole hour talking about ferrum fosforicum. How is that possible? I don't know. We're going to do it. I hope it's going to be great, and you'll tell folks to tune in. Do we use this remedy enough, ferrum fos, our beautiful, gentle cell salt? How would we use it in a higher potency? For what would we use it? In what situations? It's going to be really, really interesting. And then the following week, I'm going to come back again on the Health Inn on Monday and continue that discussion about faith in homeopathy, because it is it a religion? I don't think it is a religion. I know a lot of people talk about it as if it is, but they are so enamored with it. They have such personal proof that it is real for them, that it becomes a faith, and we have to look at that a little bit more closely. We also have on the calendar, after that, August 5th, Amy Lansky is going to come on, and then August 12th, Mary Aspinwall is going to talk about first aid and a minor illness for autistic children with sensitive digestive tracts. And we are going to also have on August 26th, Gina Tyler, the famous Gina Tyler artist, talking about detoxing autism using homeopathy. We're going to have a couple of breaks in between, I think, maybe or maybe not. And September 9th, Nancy Gales is going to talk about the power of self-care, a common sense guide to your wellness solution. She was the president of the National Center for Homeopathy for a good many years. How homeopathy prevents wellness and saves you money. Further on in the year, Linnea Hahn, who creates and manufactures an innovation of full spectrum lights, is going to talk about how full spectrum lights can brighten your life. We might have Kate Birch back on again in September talking about herd immunity. And finally, Maria Bowl, Ananda Moore, Christina Mons talking about quantum physics and of homeopathy in the unified field. We're going to have Amy Rothenberg, October 28th, how to use other natural medicine along with homeopathy. Dr. Abbas Gadimi, who is just a joy and makes me laugh, he will be on in November. Donna Powers is going to talk also in December about how to talk with a traditional medical practitioner. So you see, I've got lined up a good number of folks. For those people who are still listening, we are going to have Dr. George Fitzlucas sometime before the end of the year. That's going to be very, very exciting. And if you have people who you would like to be a guest on our show, we would love to get your suggestions. If you want to help us, because we really do need your support, and get a banner up on the Health Inn show page, that is on nissancommunications.com. He is our show producer. Each Monday I get up early. I drive out to the studio. It's as professional as it can be. We hook up via Skype all around the world to wherever our guest expert is calling in from. We have a live chat, and we have the people who can call in and ask questions or give their feedback or comment. It's a participatory event each Monday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. If you have suggestions for people who you would like to be on, or if you would like to be a sponsor, please contact me. We really, really, really need your support in that, and it will be beneficial to you as well. So we have about 20 minutes left to continue our discussion, and I will just make reference to our Facebook page, Homeopathy World Community. I've put up some pretty controversial and innovative statements, things that people have said that you need to take a look at, and we appreciate anyone who goes out there on the social networks, on the mainstream media articles, and on other homeopathic blogs. Go there. Tell them how much you love them. Tell them how much you appreciate all the information that they are disseminating out of the goodness of their hearts for free. They're just putting out this information so people will learn. And that's what Homeopathy World Community is about, spreading awareness. We have a quote here. Have we progressed since 1993? That's 20 years ago. It's not that long ago. But supposedly, our government, the United States government, was going to institute teaching the medical community more about alternative therapies. It says, have alternative therapies been instituted as official courses and accepted into modern medical practice? I think that there are a number of traditional colleges, universities, medical colleges that have given a course or two, but has it been really emphasized enough? That is a question. Are physicians allowed to use arnica and other homeopathic remedies as a standard protocol? This can be a problem. Can a physician be sued if they don't take first-line course of rigid, regimented, routine protocols of drug therapeutics and examinations? Quote, physicians today know so little about alternative medical practices that they are not able to discuss these techniques in a thoughtful and responsible way with their patients. I am pleased to tell you, says Dr. says Senator Harkin in June of 1993 at the U.S. Senate committee meeting, I am pleased to tell you that at some of the leading medical schools in this country, courses are being designed to educate health providers about alternative therapy. I have submitted as part of my written testimony the syllabus of a course I directed at Harvard Medical School, which is devoted exclusively to alternative medical practices. Other courses pertaining to this area are being developed or have been given at Stanford University, Georgetown University, Tufts University, the University of California, Arizona, Kentucky, and Virginia. And he goes on at length. This is many hundreds of pages long in that committee meeting of what was supposed to be taking place in America. We still question whether we are getting accepted. I do know that things like Reiki, music therapy, massage, these things are perhaps a little bit more acceptable. Chiropractic, definitely more acceptable. Osteopathic, there is a question that I was reading. Osteopathic medicine does not know, those trained physicians do not know that much about homeopathy either. In times of great change, it is said there are two kinds of leaders. Quote, those who usher out the old, and those are called pallbearers, and those who usher in the new, and those are called torchbearers. That is a quote from Robert F. Lehman, the chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Fetzer Institute, where he served as president from 1989 to 2000. Under his leadership as the president, the Institute developed a mission in support of mind, body, spirit health, which culminated in an Institute-funded PBS series, the groundbreaking and Emmy Award-winning Healing in the Mind with Bill Moyers. Maybe you can still get that. They might be on DVD. I don't know if some of those clips are on YouTube or Vimeo. The groundbreaking and Emmy Award-winning Healing in the Mind with Bill Moyers featured the work of a number of scientists investigating the mind-body connection. And when Robert Lehman talks about ushering out the old and ushering in the new, how do we apply that to homeopathy, which has been around for over 200 years? That is really the old. That is the ancient. That is the timeless wisdom that Herbert Roberts just told us about. Ushering in the new, what does that mean? How does that pertain to our blessed homeopathy? I think what he's talking about, what Robert Lehman is talking about, is ushering the new thought processes, the new belief systems that the mind and body are connected. He is talking about mind, body, spirit, energy, medicine, and we applaud him for that. Now, what happens in governments that try to restrict our access to information, what I call censorship? And here I was directed by, and I want to give a shout out to somebody. I don't know where I have this. If I can find it, I would like to let you know who told me about the UK 1939 Cancer Act that exerts its influence and domination in Great Britain. And this is a really wonderful article that you can take a look at. It is posted on orthomolecular.org. I told you earlier about this orthomolecular type of medicine, natural medicine, it's using megadoses, I think, of vitamin C. So would Dr. Herbert Roberts go along with it? I doubt it. However, we must investigate it and see what it can do for us. So this is how the government prevents access to information about alternative medicine to the public. They create laws forbidding the dissemination of the information. And that was done with the UK 1939 Cancer Act. Here's an excerpt from that. No person shall take any part in the publication of any advertisement that, A, contains any offer to treat any person for cancer, or to prescribe any remedy therefore, and or to give any advice in connection with the treatment thereof, which means that if you know that turmeric, if you know that this common herbal root is going to be beneficial for all of these things, including cancer, are you allowed to talk about it? Are you allowed to advise about it? Are you allowed to advertise about it? Are you allowed to say helps treat cancer or prevents cancer when you go into the grocery store and pick up that vegetable? B, no person shall take any part in the publication of any advertisement, referring to any article or articles of any description, in terms which are calculated to lead to the use of that article or articles of that description in the treatment of cancer. Again, they're targeting, you know, this really epidemic situation of cancer, of all different kinds of cancer in the human population all over the planet, in every country. So the question is, they're saying that this is saying you cannot offer to treat any person that is going to lead to refer to an article, meaning you can't even, that's why people are getting, manufacturers are getting in trouble today when they put up valid scientific research papers that have been published in authentic journals, medical journals, and they put it on their website next to their product. This is getting people into trouble today. This is getting manufacturers into trouble. And it shouldn't, because this is free information. It's out there. People will be able to access it on their own. They're just not allowed to connect it to their product or their work. In this section, the expression, quote-unquote, advertisement includes any notice, circular, label, wrapper, or other document, and any announcement made orally by any means of producing or transmitting sound. So they have covered their you-know-whats by saying any kind of communication medium, whether it be on the internet via audio or video, anything that transmits sound, does it include whispers? Does it include calling up somebody on the telephone? What does it include? And nothing written, nothing published, no documents. That's considered an advertisement. And as I think about that, if you look at publications today over the past 30 or 40 years, you open up any magazine and there's a full page spread. In small, lightly colored letters, it says advertisement. And the entire article reads like a publication, like an article. It's indistinguishable, in other words, from what appears to be a valid article, not an editorial, but an article, a news article. And there's no distinguishing from whether that or is not an advertisement. So the drug companies, they are allowed to do that, but regular folks and people in the alternative fields are not allowed to do that based on this regarding cancer in the UK. So you can see how information is being censored from the public. Publication of such advertisements is permitted to a very restrictive group comprising members of either House of Parliament, local authority, governing bodies of voluntary hospitals, registered, or training to become registered medical practitioners, nurses, or pharmacists, and persons involved in the sale or supply of surgical appliances. A very tight grip, therefore, is exercised on information that is fed to the citizens of Great Britain. Interestingly, this act does not apply to Northern Ireland. And you can find this article and much more on this topic at orthomolecular.org in their resources section. And I want to thank everyone for going to Homeopathy World Community Facebook. We have had upwards of between 17,000 and 20,000 views in the past couple of weeks. We have lots and lots of shares and comments on these informative posts that you have. And I'm still searching here for the person I want to thank who posted some information. If I can find it, I will let you know, or in the next session. So what else have we got there in the last few minutes? Lots of things go viral on Facebook. Lots of things go viral on Twitter. If you have an opinion about it, you can voice your opinion, even though we are being manipulated somewhat by the larger industries. What else would I like to tell you? I want you to tell you to be well, think positively, don't constantly get sucked into the negative news media. Here is a quote by Emmanuel James Jim Rohn, R-O-H-N, who says, "You cannot change your destination overnight. You can change your direction." So is this true for you? What is it? You know, Obama came into power based on his overriding motto of change. Is it possible to change? Is it possible to change society? It's absolutely necessary to change society because we are not heading in the right direction. It's going to be up to each and every one of us to love one another, to help one another, to support one another, to challenge ourselves to be better people. Unfortunately, I celebrated the holiday Tisha B'Av yesterday, a fast day for the world, a fast day for victims of any type of genocide, a fast day for any type of negativity in the world, for the horrible terrorist attacks and behaviors in our human population, how I cannot fathom the things that people do to each other. So we have to not only pray and get closer to each other and get closer to God, but we have to work together to better this world. And if you see something that is painful and suffering in others, we have to do something to be compassionate and understanding. And yet, if those same kinds of pains and sufferings were within ourselves, we have perhaps a different viewpoint of them to blot it out from our lives. I was fortunate to be talking about pain and suffering during yesterday's study session and how the brain works, that even though there is pain, depending upon how we as individuals find a meaning in that pain, can change the quality and intensity of that pain. So, for instance, somebody who has tremendous muscle pain because of a disease, it's very, very difficult to deal and cope with that disease. But an athlete who is pushing themselves hard to climb a mountain, to climb a cliff, to run, to beat a record, their pain and suffering is viewed in a different light. They know that their pain and suffering is for a cause and has meaning, and therefore they perhaps can even run with a broken ankle. They can do so many things and not feel the pain, because we are mind, body, spirit. We are whole. And again, it reflects back upon that theme that I questioned earlier in the show about the work and effort to accomplish, to become independent. And in our cellular structure, in our mind, in our hearts, to be full and whole. So if we see suffering in others, we must take a compassionate view. When we take a look on ourselves in our own pain and suffering, how can we bring it up to a level of joy and hope? We have to bring joy and hope to the other as well. But how can we overcome our own pain by finding meaning? We cannot tell another person what type of meaning they will find in their suffering. That is for them. That is their effort and work to dig deeply into their own soul to find out what is it, why are they suffering this pain, in order to lessen their pain and hopefully heal. So we are at the end of today's show. Gosh, I really, really appreciate everybody who has been here listening with me, who has stuck it out for 2 whole hours. Again, I'm going to remind you, I'm not going to be back again on Wednesday except for once a month with Christina Chambreau. I'm taking a break from the Wednesday shows in order to do other things. And I hope everyone out there will have a blessed and peaceful summertime. It's hot. Do what you can to rest, to get more sleep, to get out in some sunshine for a little while, 10, 15, 20 minutes a day, to eat nutritious foods with friends, enjoy, turn that TV off if you ever watch it, and even shut down the computer, because we're all addicted. We're all sucked into Facebook, and it's really not healthy. So I'm sending blessings and prayers out to everyone. Prayers for health and healing to those who are not feeling well. I'm going to send us out with a song.
Thank you for listening to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio with homeopath Debbie Brock and special guests. We encourage you to follow our show, favorite the show, click the reminder button to receive email notices when shows air. Share with your friends on Facebook and Twitter. Send in your comments and questions. See you the next time.
Across this land, both near and far, throughout the human race, within each beating heart, there is a dream whose time has come. for us to claim our birthright, each and every one. Evil hands have intervened, controlling from the shadows, think they can't be seen. But we have eyes, see in the dark, to cast a light upon the madness we embark. Let freedom ring throughout the land. Let no one trade your soul for dollars, dirty hands. Demand of the truth, transparency. For we must be the masters of our destiny.